This is The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry in for Tanzina Vega. It's good to be with you. Now, we're going to do things a little differently today because The Takeaway goes to the farm. Now, for most of us, when we hear the word farm or farmer, we imagine a heroic version of rural life, perhaps most famously told by Paul Harvey.
God said, I need somebody willing to get up before dawn, milk cows, work all day in the fields, milk cows again, eat supper, then go to town and stay past midnight at a meeting of the school board. So God made a farmer.
So you're listening here to Paul Harvey, the iconic radio man who brought America
the rest of the story
for more than 50 years. And Harvey delivered this speech, So God Made a Farmer, at the 1978 Future Farmers of America convention. And it reveals the deeply ingrained myths of our collective farming imagination.
It had to be somebody who'd plow deep and straight and not cut corners. Somebody to seed, weed, feed, breed, and rake, and disc, and plow, and plant, and tie the fleece, and strain the milk, and replenish the self-feeder, and finish a hard week's work with a five-mile drive to church. Somebody who'd bail a family together with the soft, strong bonds of sharing. Who would laugh, and then sigh, and then reply with smiling eyes when his son says that he wants to spend his life doing what dad does. So God made a farmer.
Mama, don't let them babies grow up to be cattle. Don't let them pick guitars and drive them old trucks. Make them be doctors and lawyers as such.
But these agrarian myths began to crumble in the 1980s. Suicide rates spiked among male farmers as drought and debt and foreclosure forced thousands to sell family farms to big corporations. Enraged by the loss of this all-American way of life, country music legend Willie Nelson founded Farm Aid in 1985. Let's take a listen to Nelson talking with NBC's Harry Smith in September of 2020, just as Nelson was preparing for the 35th annual Farm Aid event.
He'd come out and we'd sit on the bus and talk and drink a beer or something and talk about things.
He was the governor, Jim Thompson.
And he was telling me how bad it was getting for the farmer, for the small family farmer. After he told me what he did and we realized how important it was, 21 days later, we had our first Farm Aid.
But even as Americans rallied to shore up family farms crumbling under Reagan-era agricultural policy, the stories of Black farmers remained untold. The contributions of Black farmers were not lionized in poetry. The losses of Black farmers were not front-page stories. And the collective efforts of Black farmers to save one another were rarely heralded on the evening news. So in 1940, the year that my father was born, there were 682,000 Black farmers in the United States. By 1973, the year I was born, there were only around 45,000 Black farmers. In one generation, within our living memory, Black people lost more than 12 million acres of land. And the new owners of what accounts to more than 95% of formerly Black-owned land? Wall Street. No. Investment bankers are not putting in long days on the tractor. But as 2019 reporting from The Atlantic chronicled, multiple rounds of consolidation wrested productive acres from Black farmers and transformed them into corporate holdings. So what does it mean that Black Americans lost 12 million acres of land? Let's try to think about this in terms of the 1921 Tulsa Race Massacre. A detailed analysis from Brookings estimated that the destruction of property and business in that massacre resulted in the loss of at least $200 million in wealth. And the neighborhood that was devastated in the Tulsa Massacre was about 40 acres. So $200 million lost in 40 acres. So just consider the Black wealth that evaporated with the loss of 12 million acres. Today, around 98% of farmers are white, and those farmers also receive the vast majority of funds allocated in the COVID-19 stimulus package passed under the Trump administration. But the American Rescue Plan, passed in March under President Biden, was supposed to be different. Included in the package was $4 billion in debt relief to black farmers and other farmers of color.
The Emergency Relief for Farmers of Color Act begins the process of leveling the playing field for farmers and farmers, farming families of color, to help them not only recover from the devastation of these crises, but to give them the tools and the assistance to thrive after years of suffering.
That was Senator Raphael Warnock, one of the co-sponsors of the provision to provide relief to black farmers. He was speaking in March at an event organized by Acres of Ancestry and the Black Agrarian Fund. Let's hear from Lloyd Wright, a farmer from Westmoreland County, Virginia, and former director of the USDA's Civil Rights Office. Since we aired this conversation, a federal judge placed a halt on the debt relief these black farmers were set to receive. We're going to talk more about this later in the show.
Well, I mean, if we skip over the fact that we were promised 40 acres and a mule, but more recently, the Pickford lawsuit that was signed in 1999 promised black farmers that they would get compensation, debt relief, and priority for future programs, services. At the end of the process, and it took like 5 years to give them a final decision, out of the first 22,700 who applied, only 371 received partial debt relief. And during that process, many of them were informed by their attorneys that they did not need to make payments on the loan because it was going to be forgiven, because they had something in writing stating that. But at the end of the process, only a handful of them got debt relief and only partial debt relief. And many of the farmers end up losing land and their farms because the penalties and the interest had accumulated over that 5 years. So just because it's in writing, black farmers understand that that doesn't mean you're going to get it. And then in 2010, there was a process to try to do some debt relief for some of these farmers. And that didn't happen because we were able to get the House to pass it twice, actually, but we didn't get help from the department and the Senate never passed it.
Talk to me about the current Secretary of Ag, Tom Vilsack, who, of course, was also Secretary of Ag during President Obama. And for many of us, we'll remember the moment when apparently not knowing who the estimable Shirley Sherrard was, he relieved her of her position after, a conservative website put out that very doctored video. So when Vilsack came back as the secretary, did that undermine confidence, especially given that you're calling USDA the last plantation here?
Well, I mean, firing Shirley was just one of the many things that happened that was of concern to black farmers. Actually, a study indicated that blacks got less service and funding under the first Vilsack administration than we did on the prior Bush administration. And we were very concerned that we got almost nothing. So it was more than just fine, Shirley. He surrounded himself primarily with all whites in his inner circle. He treated a number of blacks the way he treated Shirley. So we were, in general, we were concerned that he was coming back. Now he's saying all the right things at the present time, but we're still concerned about this slow process. We still got the same OGC, Office of General Counsel. The Farm Service Agency is the agency that has been known to discriminate against black farmers. Those are the two who are doing the work here on putting this together. And until a farmer receives debt write-off and the 20% for the taxes and have the lien removed from their property, we are not convinced yet. Although I think we are probably closer than we were with the last two efforts that failed.
Now, Mr. Wright, I want to also talk a little bit about banks here. We've been talking about the USDA, but Secretary Vilsack says that part of what's happening is that banks aren't too excited about this legislation. They say that they're going to be losing out on profits from interest payments. So when you have had to deal with these kinds of loans, and you just helped us to understand why this debt exists, what's your perspective on what the banks are saying here?
I think in a nutshell, they're being greedy in that the banks will receive 100% of the debt. For those banks that included early payment clause, they'll get that payment as well. Chances are the banks were charging considerably more than the department. These are guaranteed loans now, which mean that they are only exposed to 10% of the debt, and that USDA guaranteed 90% of the debt. So they had limited exposure. And then if you have a lien on the property, you almost had zero exposure. And then you can get between on operating loans or up to real estate loans, somewhere between 2% to 3.5% interest if you have a direct loan with the department. These banks are charging considerably more than that. So maybe they don't have someone lined up that they can turn this money over that they're getting ready to receive and get the same interest rate on it. I'm not sure what the problem is, but they're going to be made whole. They're not going to lose a nickel, and an opportunity cost is what they're talking about, in addition to the penalty. And the penalty or the early payment clause is designed to deal with potential losses that result from an early payment. So I just think they're trying to be greedy and get paid more than they are entitled to.
Mr. Lloyd Wright is a farmer from Westmoreland County, Virginia, and former director of the USDA Civil Rights Office. Mr. Wright, thank you so much for talking with us this morning.
You're very welcome.
Just a reminder that we taped that conversation with Mr. Wright before a federal judge halted the debt relief to Black farmers last month. Now, after I spoke with Mr. Wright last month, a federal judge halted the federal government's plans to provide much-needed debt relief to Black farmers and other farmers of color. The judge sided with a group of white farmers who claimed the debt relief policy discriminates against them. Now, for more on this decision, I spoke with Congresswoman Alma Adams, who represents North Carolina's 12th District, and Representative Adams is also vice chair of the House Committee on Agriculture.
Well, Melissa, I was just devastated. I disagree with the judge's order, but I'm disappointed in the people who brought this misguided lawsuit as well. These borrowers were scheduled to receive the assistance, and so this decision is going to delay the recovery for these farmers, and they've suffered and they continue to suffer. And we just need to stay on top of this.
So if you had an opportunity to talk with these plaintiffs, with these white farmers, with the conservative groups who are defending them in court, what might you say to them about this set-aside relief for farmers of color?
Well, first of all, I would talk to them about all of the past discrimination, the fact that these are farmers who are working to make sure that they provide for their families, to make sure that they're able to stay in business. And I think I would try to at least appeal to whatever sensitivity they have. But I think it's important that we recap the history for people who don't seem to want to recognize it and just kind of put it up in their faces. The discrimination is something that I think we try to ignore. And we've seen it not just with this situation, but with the distribution of funds for historically Black colleges and so forth. And we've got 1890s that actually deal with agriculture in terms of their programs. So, I think we have to make it very clear that we have not gotten not even our fair share. We just have not been treated. These farmers have just not been treated fairly, and that they should. We should be able to appeal to some sensitivity of these white farmers.
So, Representative Adams, I want to go back for just one moment to a point that you made, and you talked about the 1890s institutions, those historically Black land grant colleges, and North Carolina A&T is among them that's in your district. Talk about the history of agriculture associated also with Black education.
Well, thank you, Melissa. You know, and let me just say North Carolina A&T is my alma mater twice. I have been very involved with doing work for our historically Black colleges and universities, and we have 19 1890s. And just as we started HBCUs many years ago because our students that looked like me and you could not attend the major majority culture schools. So in North Carolina, we have North Carolina A&T, which is an 1890 land grant. There's an 1862 North Carolina State, and we've seen discrimination throughout this process of funding for these schools. They are very much involved with not only doing research, but we have worked through the Agriculture Committee to try to get increased support. As a matter of fact, just recently we did have a hearing on 18 Black farmers, and they talked a lot about not only the schools and so forth, but I think that we're going to have to continue. Right now, what we see is that the state is required to match the funding from the federal government to our schools, and that has not been done. Historically, that has not been done. I served 20 years in the North Carolina House, and it seems that we just couldn't find the funding for North Carolina A&T that was a 1-1 match, but yet we were able to match money to North Carolina State 5 and 6 times. So that means to me that it's not a lack of funding, it's a lack of where we put our priorities. And so we've not put the priorities in terms of state government supporting our 1890s. But these schools are valuable, they're important. We are losing Black farmers day by day. The number is diminishing. And so we want to keep young people interested in agribusiness and agriculture overall. And that one of the ways to do it is to make sure that we have the funding there to provide scholarships. You can't just give them money today and say, let's produce tomorrow. I mean, we've got to be realistic about it and make sure that the ample time is provided to do all those things that they need to do.
I so appreciate you making that connection, and also that those inequities, not only in what we think of as payments directly to farmers, but to that whole system of college education also associated with those land grants, how many years of inequalities there are. I'm wondering, we also heard from Mr. Wright talking about the possibility of restructuring aspects of the USDA. Given that you are sitting there in a leadership role on the Ag Committee within Congress, is that something that you all have any capacity or power to do?
Oh, yes, we do. We provide oversight to USDA. I've always believed in making sure that we bring the stakeholders to the table, because folks like Mr. Wright, they're out here where the rubber meets the road. They're working day by day, and they're the ones who I think realistically can provide information to us that's helpful. So, you know, it is clear that we do handle the oversight, and including North Carolina A&T. And we've got to make sure that we take the advice of people who actually know this business. And yes, restructuring, you know, you can't keep things as they are just because these particular things have been in existence for many, many years. And just because you know, you always have to go back and revisit and revise. And especially if things aren't working, and certainly they've not been working for our Black farmers. So yeah, I would support that. There are many things I think that we can do in terms of holding folks accountable, putting pressure where pressure needs to be put.
Congresswoman Alma Adams represents North Carolina's 12th Congressional District. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Melissa. You keep up the good work.
Hi, y'all. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and this is The Takeaway. All this hour, we're talking about farming, agriculture, sustainability, and climate change. And this is particularly important to me because I am talking to you from my home in North Carolina, complete with my backyard barnyard.
Turns out not only do I have hens, but the other day I came out to the coop and lo and behold, I found baby chicks.
Now, during the pandemic, many of us looked for home improvement or life improvement projects to pass the time, to give our minds and our hands some meaning. And we spent that time waiting for the pandemic to end, sometimes isolated from friends and family. So we turned to nature and gardening and even raising livestock. For some, this was a way to keep our hands and minds busy amid so much uncertainty. And for others, adventures in agriculture were inspired by the holes in our supply chains and exacerbated by the pandemic itself. Here's what you told us about how the pandemic led you to experiment with backyard farming and gardening.
Hi, this is Kareem from Coatesville. My daughter and I started a garden last year, and it was such a success that we're doing our second one this year, and we've doubled the amount of space, and we're also going to be canning our tomatoes this year.
Hi, this is Elizabeth from Oakland. Last year, I planted 2 kinds of pepper, 7 kinds of tomato, 2 kinds of squash, green beans, strawberries, cucumbers, and arugula. I have pomegranates, lemon, figs, Asian pear apples. But my fence blew down and people raided my garden. So it was a big loss. Well, I hope they enjoyed it.
My name is Jane, and I am calling from Port Townsend. And during the pandemic, we got really involved in the garden and even expanded it to include 3 families. So we have a little community garden. And my chickens are happy because I'm paying much more attention to them.
Hi, this is Neil from Snoqualmie, Washington. We started growing all sorts of fresh vegetables and fruits right before the pandemic and ended up learning about all the wonderful fauna that would come and eat it. Our favorite were the bees.
Hi, this is Pat from the Boston area. And at the start of COVID, we did get a little nervous that there could be some food shortages. We planted 9 fruit trees and expanded our vegetable garden. We got 2 full-size goats that could eventually be milked. And we already had 12 chickens, and our neighbors and friends actually leaned on us for eggs during some of the egg shortages.
Hi, my name is William from Scottsdale. And during the pandemic, I actually was living in LA. I lost a tree to drought, sudden death, and had my tree cut down into logs small enough for me to move around, and I created 10 hugel culture beds, which is a method of creating layered garden beds with logs and tree limbs and tree waste layered in with things like rotted straw and rotted hay, organic steer manure, organic chicken manure, covered over with topsoil and mulch. And the result is a low water demand garden bed that's highly productive and over time will break down and continue to provide nutrient and moisture. Very happy with the results of those garden beds and look forward to repeating and adding layers each season. Thanks.
We always want to hear from you. Leave us a message and tell us how the pandemic led you to experiment with backyard farming or gardening. The number is 877-689-8253. Again, that's 877-869-8253. Stick with us. We'll be right back with more.
The Takeaway is supported by Progressive Insurance, offering Snapshot, a program that adjusts insurance rates based on safe driving habits. Now that's Progressive. Learn more at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, in for Tanzina. And today we're having a virtual field trip to the farm. And because we're doing this takeaway style, we want you to expand your idea of what counts as a farm. For example, I live in North Carolina, and my backyard is something of a farm, complete with 5 a.m. chores.
It's actually my favorite time of day. When I first get up, I usually check the raised beds. I got a ton of tomatoes on the vine, but they're all green. Need a little more sun to get them red. Got sunflowers back here, eggplant, tomato plants back here, lavender, got some cucumber. All right, so that's me getting out the chick feed. So we got babies and they need a slightly different kind of food. And then while I'm out here, I'm gonna cut some lettuce. On a work morning like this, that might be about it.
And the best part of my backyard farm are my girls.
A few leaves of kale here too. I'm gonna take all of that over for the chickens. Almost time to wake my girls up.
Oh yes, I adore these chickens. And if you've never heard of chicken math, well, let me tell you, it's real. I fell under their spell. And in just a few short years, my backyard flock has grown from just 3 hens to 24 ladies and one feisty rooster named Rakim.
Time to let out Rakim and his girls. Yeah, door open. Good morning, ladies. Oh, nobody's up? Too dark. Okay, here we go. Come on.
And it turns out I'm not the only one flocking to these birds. During the COVID-19 pandemic, many people also started raising chickens. And it's not just on farms. People in urban areas and big cities are also harvesting eggs with their backyard chickens.
Like to call that the salad bar for the chickens.
So, here to help us understand what we know about this growth in backyard chickens is Emily Shoup, poultry educator with Penn State Extension and a farmer. Emily, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hi.
So, Emily, tell us about this growth in backyard chicken keeping that we've seen throughout the country during the pandemic year.
Well, I think folks really understood that they were going to have some time at home, maybe a little longer than what we expected in the beginning. But they invested in this home food movement and making sure that they could have a safe, sustainable supply of eggs that they produced on their own. And I think that's really the big driver for why folks got into poultry in 2020 and into 2021.
And for the industry, right, what has that meant? And by industry here, I mean the folks who are supplying those chickens to us.
It really was a great boom for them. Lots of mail order hatcheries, farm stores, farm suppliers sold out of chicks really early on in 2020 and even sold out into 2021 for some different breeds and varieties of poultry that people were interested in.
Now, it is not hard to keep chicks and chickens in your backyard, but it does take a little bit of work and know-how. So what I want to do is take a quick break. And then when we come back, Emily, I want you to walk us through some of what folks need to know if they are going to get themselves part of this big chicken keeping boom. But before we go, just what's your one biggest piece of advice to folks?
Plan ahead.
So, Emily, I want to start with asking you what it is that Extension Services do, because I got to tell you, y'all have been so useful to me in my own chicken keeping adventures.
Well, that's great to hear. That makes sure that my job is useful. So as an Extension agent, we provide science-based education for everyone, really anything from livestock to horticulture to family and consumer sciences, lots of different types of things. But this year, my job mostly has been dealing with backyard chickens.
And are chickens the starter sort of backyard farming possibility, or are folks also starting with ducks, pigs? What have you been seeing on that?
Yeah, we've seen a lot of different types of poultry. So poultry, we kind of identify as anything with that we can use for feathers, meat, eggs, or, those types of commercial things that we can use with birds. But seen a lot of small ruminants, so goats, sheep, as well as rabbits. Folks are getting into small flocks of rabbits now, or herds, I guess, of rabbits. but yeah, it seems like it's kind of the gateway animal chickens are, because there's really low cost. Right now, not so much because feed prices are kind of increasing, but low input costs, and they have a relatively small footprint for a chicken coop versus if you were going to invest in like a dairy cow or beef cattle or something like that.
So talk about the footprint. About how much space do you need if you're going to keep some chickens in your backyard?
For an adult hen of average size, we say about 2 square feet per bird, linear square feet. You can always provide more, but we always say don't provide any less than that. And that just keeps those birds happy and able to do their natural behaviors like pecking and scratching and dust bathing, sunning themselves, things like that.
So here's the question I'm consistently getting from my neighbors. And by the way, I give away a lot of my eggs, which makes them a lot more tolerant of my rooster, Rakim. But folks ask me, do you need a rooster in order to have eggs?
No, you actually don't. Hens will lay eggs on their own. If you want fertile eggs, you do need a rooster. If you're going to plan to hatch those eggs and want chicks for maybe next year and chicks out of your own flock or out of your own girls. But yeah, you don't technically need a male in your coop in order to have eggs.
Now, when you are getting calls from folks who are starting on their adventures, what kinds of questions are they asking you about this process of keeping chickens in their backyards?
A lot of what I get right now is disease issues. So not that poultry are disease-ridden animals or anything like that, but folks may have some issues with birds that just aren't acting or feeling themselves. So they'll call me and we'll kind of discuss those issues. A lot of times it is a management type thing. So just the way that they're caring for those birds. And then sometimes it does require a veterinarian. And unfortunately, I'm not one, but I have lots of friends that that I work with. So I can refer those to our veterinarians.
One of the things I have found kind of most surprising and maybe even distressing at times has been predators. And even though we do, you know, all the things you're meant to do, there's kind of no way to be 4 or 5 years into some serious chicken keeping and not have lost some chickens to everything from raccoons to hawks to most recently quite a wily fox. So it took us a while to, you know, sort of secure against. What kinds of things do you tell folks who are having predator problems? And I mean, we really live like in town and yet we have all of these.
Yeah, absolutely. I have a friend actually that works at Cornell. She's an extension agent and she's had issues with fox this year. It really depends on the animal that you're after. The predator is to be specific, but I always tell folks to get in contact with their local game warden. There may be ways that they can trap or remove those animals that are a nuisance. Without having to harm that animal, they can release them back into the wild, the true wild, not the suburbs. And when it comes to aerial predators, that seems to be the one that's big in my area where we're talking about eagles and hawks and things like that. There are permits that you can get to trap or remove those animals from your property. Just get in contact with your local game commission. Those folks are the experts in that field.
Yeah, and we found a little bird netting over the top of the run area also worked pretty darn well to deter those hawks. Can I ask also about another predator, which is humans? And maybe not so much predatory, but it certainly is true that some municipalities are not friendly to chicken keeping. What kinds of things do folks need to know before, as a legal matter, before they start keeping? And what are our options to maybe expand the legal footprint for this fantastic backyard activity?
Yeah, the big thing is to check with your local municipality, whether that's your township, your city, your HOA, whatever your most local zoning authority is, before you invest in poultry. It's never a good idea to run to Tractor Supply or another farm store supplier, grab chicks, come home, and then go look that up. It's that planning. I try to drill that home every time I talk, but yeah, planning ahead, making sure you're in contact with those folks and that you understand the rules, because some zoning ordinances may say you can only have so many hens, no roosters, or something like that. Some places are a lot looser with their restrictions. Some people just outright don't want backyard poultry in their neighborhoods, and that's understandable. However, it is a great activity, especially for kids. And when I see ordinances that really prevent kids from participating in this project, that makes me kind of sad. But ways that we can to kind of fight against these ordinances is that if you do have a chicken coop in existence that's maybe out of regulation, making sure that that coop is clean, it is well kept, it's not an eyesore for the community. That tends to make folks a little more receptive to changing that ordinance. And then, you know, not to plug my own work, but taking some classes with Penn State or getting familiar with your local extension service and what they have to provide, that education piece is really important so that your township zoning authority or wherever you live, they understand that you know what you're doing and that you're going to do this right and do it right by the birds as well.
So speaking of doing right by the birds, I'm a little worried. We know that pandemic puppies are being dropped off now at many shelters as a result of folks going back to work. Are your pandemic chickens okay if you finally get a chance to take a summer vacation?
Yeah, just make sure you have somebody to feed and water and monitor their behavior while you're gone. Neighbors, family members, something like that.
And I'll say it again, free eggs go a long way to making your neighbors happy and sometimes even your city council folks happy. Emily Shoup is a poultry educator with Penn State Extension and a farmer. Emily, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Now, in the new Netflix series, High on the Hog, host and food writer Stephen Satterfield traces the history and significance of African-American foodways. The show is based on a book of the same name by the renowned historian and cookbook author, Dr. Jessica B. Harris.
Are you familiar with the phrase high on the hog?
Oh, yeah. Going back in the slavery days, hog was a big deal. Folks on the plantation would kill it for their master, but all they got was the parts of the hog, like the feet and the tail and the intestine.
Part culinary show, part travelogue, the four-episode docuseries follows Satterfield as he travels to West Africa and across the U.S. to bring audiences the stories of the Black people who've shaped U.S. food culture, past and present. The chefs, historians, preservationists, activists, and more.
When you understand your history and understand where you come from, that understanding gives you purpose.
We call our food soul food. We are the only people who named our cuisine after something invisible that you could feel, like love and God.
For more on the importance of a show like High on the Hog, we're joined now by Osai Endelin, a James Beard award-winning writer and co-author of The Rise, Black Cooks and the Soul of American Food. Osai, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me, Melissa.
So let's just dig right in. Why does this show have such, as you wrote in the New York Times, profound significance?
Well, that significance occurs on many levels, but that significance happens first just in the existence of this narrative itself. This history is not new, as viewers of the show have come to realize, as readers of Dr. Harris's work have known for quite some time, but we haven't seen it presented in this way. And that begs the question, why is that? And that starts to turn our attention toward the decision makers and the gatekeepers in the realm of media and entertainment who get to decide just who it is that gets to be on planes and boats traveling to far off lands, explaining to American audiences what food is important or interesting or curious and what cultures are worthy of closer looks. And that hasn't really ever been a privilege extended to Black people or Black creators, not necessarily with the kinds of budgets that we're accustomed to seeing in other travelogues. So I felt that it was important to articulate that the timing of this story is important, not just because of what is happening in African-American history right now, but because of how long it has taken for us to get such a core element of our history portrayed in such a clear and artistic and beautiful way.
It really is beautiful. And I have to say there's this one portion, one storytelling that just had me screaming and hollering and jumping in my living room as I was watching it. And it's really the story of James Hemings. And I've taught that for a lot of years as part of kind of, you know, my courses in American politics. But can you tell us a little bit about the story of James Hemings?
Yes, and you know, I'll have to say the one of the best people to consult for that is Adrian Miller, who wrote a beautiful book called The President's Kitchen Cabinet, the details, the experiences, and the history of Black people in and around the White House throughout our nation's history. And he's in two episodes of High on the Hog. But, you know, James Hemings was a chef who was trained in France, and he was an enslaved chef who worked for Thomas Jefferson. And it is through the training that he received in France and his own innovations and creativity and craftsmanship that he brought back to the United States that he helped establish the fine dining culture that, you know, we have come to understand as being uniquely Eurocentric and you know, aspirationally American. It is, in fact, many Black people who have been part and parcel of forming that legacy for us. And that in itself is surprising to many people, but not to folks who perhaps have been closely watching the restaurant industry over the last couple of centuries.
And for me, it also, it's part of connecting back to your point around sort of who has the budget to travel log, right? I was also thinking, if you go to Mount Rushmore, you know, there's like a little plaque that will tell you Thomas Jefferson created ice cream. Not Jefferson, right? Right. We need to go to Hemings, right? So it's always about asking that question behind. And I think that's part of what I find fascinating about High on the Hog is that it actually doesn't start with enslavement here in the U.S. It begins in West Africa, in Benin. And for those who haven't watched the series yet, why does it matter to begin there in West Africa?
It matters because that's where our ancestors originated from. And when you understand that these human beings brought with them traditions and practices and cultures that were already well in existence, you understand that they took what they already had and made the best that they could with what they were offered, which wasn't very much, you know, upon arrival to what eventually became the United States. And that's a point that gets missed, you know, in a way that I think is so prohibitive to all students of this history, because it robs us both of an understanding that the continent of Africa lost something too in the transatlantic slave trade. You know, in modern times, we might call that a brain drain, you know, if you work for a tech company. But there's an incredible loss of resources, of intergenerational presence that happened on that side too. And of course, the colonial impact in Africa is still incredibly harmful and damaging. One of the things I really like about High on the Hog is that it also articulates that the culture in Benin and in neighboring countries, as you might surmise, is not static, and that those culinary voices are changing and adapting as well. So as much as you have people still trying to make the food of their grandparents and their great-grandparents, they're also taking the experiences and the influences of different cultures and travel experiences that they're doing to affect their cuisine and what they want to put on the table. Just as people here are saying, you know, I'm not only going to cook with the ingredients that are available in my backyard. I want to incorporate the experiences that I had in Japan or the experiences that I had in Brazil in the food that you're having here, which if you are of African descent, becomes a lot easier to do and to connect those dots once you understand the movement of Black people throughout the diaspora, because where we go, our food went too.
My one advice for folks who are watching this series is be sure you've got some food in the house to cook, because it is going to make you hungry. Moving from all the way from James Hemings to Michael Twitty, it gives us that intergenerational look. Thank you so much, Osai Endelin. James Beard, award-winning writer and co-author of The Rise, Black Cooks and the Soul of American Food. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Melissa.
All right, y'all. Appreciate you being with us on this special Farming Hour on The Takeaway. And if you want to listen to the entire episode, it's in podcast form at thetakeaway.org or anywhere you get audio. And hey, we're back live next week with all sorts of new stories, conversations, and news that you need to know. We appreciate having you along for the ride, as always. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, in for Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.